So, I'd like you to help me obey Proverbs 8 today. Hear, for I will speak of excellent things. This is going to be an excellent sermon, even if it's really bad, because we're talking about excellence. So, when I was going to grammar school, they had a grading scheme. Most of you had A, B, C, D, E, F. No, A, B, C, D, F. I got mainly E's and a few F's when I was going to grammar school. Yeah, it's like E's actually were A's. They stood for excellent. So they had EG, excellent, good. I don't know what the middle one was because I usually didn't get that. Yeah, probably, well, no, then I think the F's was for flunk. I consistently got F's in handwriting because I was left-handed in a right-handed Catholic school. You had to hold your paper a certain way, regardless of whether you were left or right-handed, and yeah, it just didn't work, so I just kind of gave up. So I could always count on some consistency, although a few teachers took pity on me and bumped me up to a D. Fortunately, I didn't do GPAs back there because I would have been really distraught because it ruined my GPA. But excellent is a characteristic that's kind of lost in our culture because we want everyone to be equal. So they're but excellent by definition in English is something that excels or goes beyond the norm. And also by definition, most people are average. But we want to kind of get rid of those outliers, and we've kind of dumbed down things. And I came across Caleb, as most of you know, we're going to be doing him eventually, who had a different spirit in him, who followed God fully. He was kind of above average. And as I started working on this, I was listening to Daniel. And in Daniel 5, he is said to have an excellent spirit. And we're going to look a little bit at him because he has some of the characteristics that we kind of need. So, in considering the subject of excellence, there are three little things that are really easy. You need to follow objectives, follow through, and follow up. It's actually really simple. Follow objectives. Follow through till you get things persist, and then follow up diligence, making sure you got everything you're supposed to get. And it kind of gives rise to excellence. As most of you know, the Greek word arete or arete is the highest Greek virtue. It's having your passions governed by objectives. We'll look at that in a lot more depth. And when I start studying something, I look at what the scriptures have to say. I think about it, reason, and then I see if this really actually works. It's kind of the way you arrive at truth. So I went to TED, TED Talks, to kind of see if they had anything like this. And as most of you know, TED is a fairly liberal bias, and they had the worst stuff on excellence. It was like they don't want people to be excellent. There was one video that was not super well done. But the content was excellent, and I'm going to be talking about that in a few minutes. There was this guy that the New Testament talks about called Jesus, who did all things well. And people were beyond measure astonished, of average astonishment. Whoa, this guy does all things well. He makes the deaf to hear and the dumb to speak. When I was teaching at a university, public university, I was able to get the last one in there by opening up the class to discussion. I could probably get them to speak. And then I had my major battle was getting the deaf to hear. Get off your phones and pay attention so we can discuss this. But doing all things well is really good if you're divine. As humans, doing all things well, it's kind of really hard. So we're going to talk about the difference between excellence and perfectionism and why you want one and not the other. So I'm going to start with Daniel because there's some really good things to understand about him. And I think that's the next screen. All right. So was it Nebuchadnezzar? One of those kings back then had bad dream. And his wife comes to the rescue. Wake up, wake up. And she says to him, "There's a man in your kingdom in whom is the spirit of the Holy God." Wow, Holy Spirit. And in the days of your father, there was in him light, which is illumination, and understanding and wisdom. And his wisdom was like the wisdom of the gods. Those were found in him, and King Nebuchadnezzar, there it is, your father, the father of the king, made him chief among the magicians, astrologers, Chaldeans, who were supposed to be wise people, and soothsayers. Those were people who said sooth. Sooth. A couple months ago, I actually looked up soothsayer, thinking, okay, I know the joke. I've used the joke for years. What in the world does sooth mean? And I found out it's an old English word for truth. So there were people who spoke the truth. Who knew? And inasmuch as an excellent spirit, it's the very next verse, knowledge and understanding and interpreting dreams and solving riddles and explaining enigmas were found in this Daniel, who the king named Belteshazzar. I guess you could also pronounce his name without stumbling over it. Let Daniel be called and he'll give the interpretation. And Daniel comes in and saves the day. In him was an excellent spirit. In him was knowledge. In him was understanding. And besides all that, those things are all things that we can get. He could interpret dreams, solve riddles, and explain enigmas. He'd be great to do Bible study with. So, inquiring minds wanted to know, how did Daniel get this stuff? Like, why was he so good? And you have to go back to the beginning of the book. And there was one thing that Daniel did that made all this other stuff happen. He became a vegetarian. So, most of you know the story. I'll give you a little more of the background. So, Nebuchadnezzar's Babylon, God delivered all the surrounding nations into Nebuchadnezzar's hand, or the Babylonians' hand. Israel was supposed to have done that task, but because they failed, he raised up Nebuchadnezzar to do it, and then eventually he gets rid of Nebuchadnezzar. Actually, this guy before Nebuchadnezzar. I can't remember who he is. So, Daniel is culled from all the exiles. They took the noble children, the young guys. I don't think they took girls. And the ones who were trained, who were good to look at, because yeah, you didn't want some ugly guy in your court because, oh, what was that? And they educated him for 3 years, super duper executive MBA, which also had arts and literature attached to it. And these were the guys who were going to eventually serve in the king's court. So the entire Middle East that had been conquered, they took the cream of the crop, they put them together. And because these guys were so privileged, they were actually on a meal plan where they would have meat and wine from the king's table. Now, if you know what a ziggurat is, it's like a pyramid with steps. At the center and top of these things, they found a room. And in this room was a table, and on this table was put the finest food in the land. And the theory behind it was that the king would share a meal with the gods there. And then the leftovers would be given to, you know, his favored and then these favored people. And by sharing a meal with the gods, you were partaking of the gods' nature. So Daniel didn't want to do that because he was loyal to the god that lost, which is kind of silly. Why would you be loyal to a god that basically sent you into captivity? Now think about it. Daniel is in Babylon. Jerusalem has been burned. The temple has been destroyed. The Babylonians have totally wiped out Israel. They have transported the entire nation down there. And it looks like the Israelites are losers, and in the ancient Near East context, so are their gods. Yet Daniel held true to their God. And Daniel purposed in his heart, I forget which translation says that, that he would not defile himself with the king's meat. I think it's 1:7 or something like that. He used to memorize that stuff like that. And that is the key to his success. So he does this 10-day experiment, you know, lettuce, eat veggies, and drink water, and you compare the meat, wine people, and let's do it for 10 days. And if you know we're not better than they are, then we don't want you to lose your head. We'll eat the meat. So God gave Daniel favor in the eyes of the one who was in charge of them, who was a pretty high mucky muck, who could still lose his head if he did something the king didn't like. And lo and behold, 10 days later, Daniel and his friends, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, looked better, and the king let them continue to eat veggies, and they didn't have to defile themselves. That was the one thing that we have Daniel do. And then, look at verse 17. As for these four young men, Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, God gave them knowledge and skill in all literature and wisdom. I wonder if I was a vegetarian at seminary, I would have been able to claim this verse. Anyway, and Daniel had understanding in all visions and dreams. And at the end of the days, when the king said that they should, appear before him or something like that, the eunuchs brought them in, and the king interviewed them, summoned, and among them all, none was found like Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, because he changed their names again. And therefore, they served among the kings. And in all matters of literature and all this other stuff, you can go read it, they excelled. So Daniel's purposing to be loyal to God is the thing that caused God to bless him. And then as a result, let's go back and see that list of stuff. Light, illumination, understanding, and wisdom. God gave him wisdom. Like the wisdom of the gods. So in our praise time, we just had examples of the wisdom of the scriptures affecting lives positively yet today. And in him was an excellent shining spirit. I think in your notes somewhere I have a little thing to Daniel or something. There's this image that comes up, and it's a shining image, and they use the same word, excellent. So it's like really outstanding beyond anything else. As well as the basics of knowledge and understanding, which are things that we as New Testament saints need to have in our repertoire. So in our time together, and I think I'm going to expand this to two sermons, I just decided this morning, because there's no way I'd be able to do the topic justice, and there's some fun stuff we're going to do as well. The first thing you have to do is follow objectives. And then you have to follow through in attaining those objectives, and then you have to follow up to make sure you actually got it. And lo and behold, you'll be excellent. So, as I mentioned before, we named our debate club Arete, and people couldn't say Arete, so we just said Arete. It's funny because they were supposed to be doing dramatic speeches, but they couldn't get the accent right. Passions, your desires, what you are motivated by, are not animalistic. It's not just to eat and breed. It's to actually do something that's higher. And I'm a real fan of the Greeks. I taught a course on world cultures, and I looked at every single culture. And in every culture, you have some really wise men. I got a couple of Confucius quotes in here. Most of them are Greeks. The Greeks spent hundreds and hundreds of years examining life. And that's where we get a guy like Socrates and his disciples, Aristotle and Plato. And we're actually going to look at another disciple of Socrates called Xenophon, which most people don't hear of him because he was a Spartan. He was kind of like a Navy SEAL trained, but he was also a historian as well as a soldier, and a philosopher, and a writer, and author. And the reason you don't hear as much about him is the Athenians beat the Spartans, and the victors write history. But he's got some really good stuff. So you want to have your passions governed by objectives. But before you have excellence, you need competence. You need to have basic skills, like being able to read, write, speak, walk without stumbling when you're chewing bubble gum at the same time. And I looked up competence, because I had my concept of it. I was bored a lot in grammar school, so I used to read whatever I could, and I used to read dictionaries. So, It's like, it was either that or the phone book. You know, phone book, great list of characters, but no plot. Dictionary, great plot, but a little confusing. Anyway, the thing that, where we go? Here we go. The Business Dictionary came up with, I think, a really good definition of competence. Because there's actually a progression here. Abilities. Everyone has abilities. You want to find out the things that you're, you know, best woven together, gifted in, and be able to maximize your talents in there. Followed by commitments. So just having a, you know, a talent or ability is lost if you don't have a commitment to do something with it. And that commitment is going to result in acquiring knowledge, but knowledge that you don't know how to use is kind of useless. Therefore, you need skills. You put all those together and you're going to be competent. And then you just need the follow-up or follow-through, follow-up to actually shine in having excellence. And I would like to see you have excellence both in your work, in your ministry, and in other areas of your life. And hopefully we'll be able to achieve that. This is Wikipedia. So people do Wikipedia, some of them do a really good job. You know, my colleagues will always rail against it because basically it would replace them. I always encourage my students to use it, but judiciously. A person of highest effectiveness is what they call arete. They use all their facilities, strength, bravery, and wit to achieve real results. Now, the Greeks didn't say that, as a person, but they kind of go on to say that this is basically expression of what it means to be fully human and fully alive. Use all of your being to push the right objectives and strive towards them, and that is called arete. When Achilles goes to try and dies in battle, that was considered great arete. The person who won the Olympic Games was considered great arete, or to have great arete. But arete isn't just a characteristic of people. It's actually a characteristic of, there's a place where it's a chimney. What, a chimney? An excellent chimney. Because it had the characteristics that it was supposed to have and had them well. And it was an excellent chimney. So it did its job. The smoke got channeled out. Didn't let the rain in. It provided, you know, places to cook. So this concept of arete is you have to have a blueprint of what life is supposed to be like, and then you actually have to build your life according to it. That's why I'm a real fan of the Greeks, because they spent a lot of time thinking about what the ideal life is. Their architecture reflects it. Their art reflects it. And in that same vein, Michelangelo's David, you know, he's like the perfect thing, actually. Yeah, not human because it's so beyond human. But they tried to reflect this in so many areas of their experience. And they thought and they wrote about it. And I'm sure other cultures did, but we have their writings that are survived. So arete was such a valuable characteristic that there are some stories about it. The Greeks call a guy you know as Heracles, same guy. And there's story of the Wikipedia article mentioned, I'll tell you where I got this so you can find it on your own, of the minor goddess Arete, who was the daughter of Justice, and an other minor goddess whose name was Happiness, or really called Kakia, which is the Greek word for evil. And there's a story where Heracles meets these two, and I think I'd like to share some of it with you. I won't do the whole thing. It's going to be a little Shakespearean for some of you because I'm going to do this first. So I'm going to come back to it in a minute. But I'll share it and then kind of give you a taste of what you can find on your own. So first I'll set this stage when I listen to my TED Talks. So I was really disappointed because like when I did Happiness, you know, TED was a good resource. You know, you find people have spent their, you know, 10 years studying a subject and they come and do their thing. excellence was just like most of the stuff said, doing what you feel like was excellence. And the one guy in particular that it was painful to listen to him. Most of you know the book Blink, your initial impression, and then you kind of verify it. So, you know, 3 seconds into the thing, I thought, oh, this is going to be bad. And it was. Now, if you ever watch a TED Talk, the guys are in t-shirts usually, or, you know, they're really casual. If they're wearing a jacket, it's open. This guy is there in a suit, dark suit, white tie. Everything was buttoned. You know, the jacket was buttoned for the entire thing. His appearance to me screamed, Pastor! And in front of a liberal church, like every hair was in place. And he was so painfully slow trying. I mean, he's used to talking to people that probably, you know, couldn't listen very fast. And he's just trying to paint these word pictures. And, you know, the big thing was he helped this little girl out of the mud, like stuck in her boots and everything. I mean, she went cut through the field in mud, caught. He went and rescued her because this little thing inside him told him to do that. And therefore, he did it and he felt really good. And that was excellence. And, like, and then his takeaway was, you know, like you have to kind of figure out what's inside you and then just follow it. And that makes you excellent. And I'm thinking, no, that's just so wrong. How would that apply to chimneys? You know, chimney says, I have a fire inside me. Yeah, of course, you're a chimney. You're supposed to have a fire inside you. So then I found a guy. This is people's objective in life. To wonder half-heartedly after mediocrity. To meander in the general of direction of whatever's most urgent and noisy. To which I would add attractive. To stroll nonchalantly after the easiest and most comfortable option, as long as there's nothing to watch on TV that night. Yeah, that's how people tend to live. And it just, someone described that, someone at work is like, to do just enough not to get fired and be paid just enough not to go somewhere else. And that described the workforce. I'm thinking, whatever happened to arete? Whatever happened to excellence? And we have a culture that kind of mitigates against this stuff, militates against this stuff. They don't want that. I just found them digging up some, you know, I look at a lot of stuff I didn't hit. But they were basically someone describing how our culture. Yeah, don't follow this, right? Do not follow this. it's kind of like the bad, better, best objectives in toil, but I thought they were expressed well and cut and paste, and wow, they're there. Okay, so the one that I found that I really liked, I should give you the reference to it. You can find it. This guy wasn't the best speaker. You know, he was dressed like you'd normally expect a TED Talk guy to dress, slovenly. And he studied sprinters and Bolt was at the top of this peak. What's his first name again?
Usain.
Usain Bolt. Okay. And he has a thank you, bell curve of great sprinters who have done sub, was it 10 second sprints. And he has a little X on there and it forms a perfect bell curve. And at the very top, two guys. And then on top of that is Uriah Bolt with the fastest time in the world. And then he went through to describe how some of the people way down at the bottom were actually at the time the fastest guys in the world. And the thing that I found really interesting, he said, okay, so on this chart, I'm going to show you the ones who were not Africans from a certain part, West Africa. And there's like two or three white guys. That was it on the whole chart. One time, there's some American sprinter who was an Anglo. And he said they just had the natural talent. But just having natural talent isn't enough. And then he described the process by which these guys kept breaking the records. And a couple things that came out of them was they channeled or focused their abilities on the goal. Okay, this is just like toil stuff. By the way, excellence is toil. You know, it's nothing new on it. I read a dozen blogs on excellence, and it's just basically telling you stuff you'll find in toil. And it's basically how to succeed. It doesn't really get you how to be excellent, so hopefully we'll go a little beyond that. Obviously, an Olympic sprinter focuses on the goal. And the thing that was interesting is that for 9 years, a record would stand, and then somebody would break that record, and then in the next month, 40 people would break it. For 9 years, people are trying to do it. And then one guy does it, and then they realize, yes, it's possible. And they kind of reach down inside to get that extra to push. And some of these things are timed in thousandths of a second. They showed two third place finishers in the Olympics. A thousandth of a second separated them. And the guy said, it depends on how you wore your hair that day, you know, because of the wind resistance. One thing I didn't know is, like, I always thought, you know, if you're up high, there's less oxygen, so it's harder to run. But that's actually an advantage because the air is thinner and doesn't provide as much resistance. Who knew? You know, the amount of oxygen in the air actually slows you down when you're sprinting. It's amazing. They eliminated distractions. And I just want to do a little sidebar on this one here. I had a friend who was a model. He went down to Miami Beach once upon a time to have for a photo shoot. And a month later, he was down there for 3 days. A month later, the photo came out. Photo, single. New York Times, Fashion Mag, there it was. A one-page or two-page spread. One shot of him. That was it. Wearing a particular blazer of some sort. And I asked him, you know, well, what did you do for the 3 days? And, you know, we shot all day. And I remember something one of my profs said, that the key to quality is quantity. The key to a good movie is how much is on the cutting room floor. What they cut out because the flow wasn't there. You know, Walt Disney obviously was a premier movie maker of his day. And there was an animator in, I think, Snow White and Seven Dwarfs, who spent 240 days doing a 3-minute sequence or 4-minute sequence of, I think, the dwarfs making a meal and messing up the kitchen, which was really funny. And it wound up on the cutting room floor because Walt said, you know, it just slows down the pace of the movie. And like all that effort, the guys, you know, not just one guy works on it. You know, there's the colorist, there's like a whole, you know, minor army of people that work on the Disney films. They eliminated it because it distracted from the flow of the movie. And I think when we stand before Christ, one of the things that he's going to look at is not just what we've done, but what's on the floor around our feet. What have we cut out of our lives in the pursuit of excellence in our relationship with him? Another thing that I noticed in the sprinters is they all pushed beyond the comfort zone. Yes, they were the best sprinter in their country. They were one of the top, you know, five in the world. But they kept pushing and pushing and pushing. They never stopped. And then they had coaching. So this is one of the things that was a real contrast behind do whatever is inside you to you need a coach. And good coaches are usually martinets. They demand the best of their players, athletes, whatever it is. And they push them beyond their limits. And I remember when I was in high school, all the people were not thrilled with the coach because he made them work so hard. But he was trying to produce the best out of his athletes. And we're actually going to see a couple coach quotes down below. And then they had competition to spur them on. So by racing against the best, they tried to excel and did their best as a result. In the Christian circles, we're not big on competition, but we're big on fellowship, which spurs one another on. We hear, that person trusted God for that. I want to trust God for that. It's this thing that drives us. I attained a fairly rapid reading speed because I want to find out what's going to happen next. It all goes back to a very I guess formative area thing in my life when I was like, 4 or 5 years old, could have been three. My parents had assigned my sister the task of reading to me, and my sister was evil, no doubt about it. She would read, and then she'd say, "And the big bear said, 'Okay, that's it.' I want the bear said." Yeah, I was like, it's like, so yeah, I kind of relate to Harry and Dudley. Yeah, it's just like, my father would tell that story as I was growing up. That's why I remember it. But I kind of wanted to read, find out what was next. And then when I got to school, I was about the 5th grade. I sat across the row from a guy called Peter Flack, and he was a pretty bright guy. I always remember him because I have a little piece of graphite embedded in my shoulder from when he stabbed me with a pencil. But that's not why I remember him. I remember him because one of the more fun things in the 5th grade that you didn't have to just sit there and fall asleep was that they gave us this reading thing. And if you, it was like an SRA reading. It was a thing that basically preps you for the SAT and GREs, the reading comprehension thing. So the faster you get through it, the then you can go on to the next one. So Peter and I are there, and we're reading, and I guess we both had fairly decent reading rates, and we basically got up to go get the next one in the series at the same time. Oh. And then I pushed to get a little bit ahead of Peter, and then he pushed to get ahead of me. And as a result of that, just getting pushed for the next page, I could never qualify for a speed reading course. Because whenever they gave you the pretest, it was basically what the post test was supposed to be. And I remember sitting next to a guy, a friend of, actually used to come to BAC. And he went to Cornell as a classics major, and then he got his Harvard Law degree. And he's sitting there with a stopwatch and a book. I said, "What you doing?" And he said, "I'm just trying to increase my reading comprehension." This is, I guess, in between Cornell and Harvard. And I just basically turn the page every time it's like 30 seconds. Forces them to read faster and faster and faster. And it pushes you out of your comfort zone. And fellowship, if basically we should spur one another on to love and good deeds by our example that pushes people out of their comfort zone. And that's how you get away from mediocrity towards excellence. Here's a guy I bet you never heard of. Well, actually, some anybody in the computer world might have heard. Azim Premji. I don't know if you know of him, but he is the second richest man in India. When Pakistan was formed, the leader of Pakistan wanted to take him for the country, and he said, "Nah, I'm going to stay." His father, his grandfather was a rice farmer. His father started a cooking oil business. Azim went to Stanford and then had to drop out because he his father died, heart attack, and he had to come home and take over the family business. And he moved into, soaps and everything that you make from oil. And then when IBM got kicked out of India, he decided to get into microcomputers. And one of the journalists writing about him said he went from Crisco to computers, because he went, but he still actually has the oil business. It's still running. It's still profitable. It's great. And he developed a computer system using a technology of a defunct, now defunct company in Cincinnati. He took what they had, was producing something cheaper and better than IBM, and it basically swept. He now runs, oh, it's like MirrorPro or something like that. MyPro, it, what? MirrorPro. Yeah, it's like the number one software company in India, if not, that services a lot of Fortune 500 companies. And he had this quote. I'm a huge fan of quotes. It saves me reading books. So I figure someone's gone through and they picked out the important stuff. And it's easy to, read a quote, think about it, and then you try to figure out what kind of book went with it. And, it's like when I had to do Napoleon, instead of reading a biography of Napoleon, I just got, 300 quotes by Napoleon, his actual words, put them together. And I know Napoleon better than most biographers because I'm doing it basically out of his own words. And it's a great way to learn stuff. So I'm a fan of quotes. This one is, I think, particularly good. Excellence endures and sustains. It actually sustains you. The pursuit of excellence sustains you. It goes beyond motivation into the realms of inspiration. I think people in our current culture would probably consider this a concept of flow. When you really get into something, you're pursuing it with all you've got. It's momentum that drives you, and it causes you to take initiative and go different places where you normally wouldn't go. So the idea behind this is excellence might take work, but once you start pursuing it, it becomes self-motivating. The journey of 1,000 steps begins with 30 miles being the first step. Okay, so, and then you keep taking, you get momentum, you keep going. I'm going to come back eventually to the thing I wanted to read to you. Famous race car driver. I remember him growing up as, you know, he was like one of the superstars of the NASCAR circuit, probably before they had a NASCAR circuit, Mario Andretti. And, you know, I never thought driving race cars was that difficult or, yeah, challenging. But then I kind of looked into it a little deeper and I realized, yeah, those guys can kill themselves, really. So it's like actually requires a lot to keep focused, particularly if you have this thing where you're doing, you know, hundreds of laps around something. He says, desire is the key to motivation. So if you want something, you want it really badly, you're motivated to get it. So when I put together TOIL, I looked at all the time management stuff, and I looked at particularly at all the sales stuff, because salespeople really have to be motivated, and it's tough to keep that motivation up. And a lot of the sales schools will start out trying to give people what tap into their desires, and then they show them by knocking on those doors, you get, or making those calls, you will get the thing that you desire. If you just stay an extra 5 minutes later, you make an extra five calls, you will basically, you know, excel beyond the competition, which is excellence. Desire is the key, but it's determination, like Daniel purposed in his heart, and commitment to a unrelenting, that means don't give up, never give up, never give up, never give up, pursuit of your goal. Oh, gee, I guess I better have a goal. It's a commitment to excellence that will enable you to attain the success that you seek. So let me pause and meddle here for a bit. What are you seeking? What are you seeking? And if you look at the bad, better, best objectives, most people just want to get through the day without too much of a hassle. Seeking mediocrity, actually pretty easy, but it's not the road that you really want. Somewhere along the line in some tape series I listened to 40 years ago, the guy said, it's probably Earl Nightingale or Dennis Conay, said something along the lines of, a hard life is just as difficult as a successful one. And as I thought about it, you see, you know, someone basically is homeless. They've got no responsibilities. They can sit on the street all day long. They can get high or get drunk. It's just like, not all homeless people are like this, so I don't want to be politically incorrect. But there's a lot of them that are just like that. You know, I would, you know, initially tell people about, oh, there's this mission we support, Maori Mission, or we call it Water Street Mission, and you get a free meal there. So they're like, no, I don't want that. I just, you know, want to get high. But they're there. It's hard for them to get the next meal. It's hard when it rains. It's hard when the temperature drops. It's hard to figure out how to have internet access or wash your clothes or any of the other stuff that, you know, the people who live in cubicles sometimes have to do. So it's, you know, you have to seek the right things, because the thing that you seek, you'll eventually make more progress towards. I, for one, do not want to be seeking the wrong things. And before I get to the application, I'm going to take you back to my Greek guys. Any questions thus far? No, competence is just the starting point. Okay, so being competent means you get the stuff done that needs to get done. You hit the standard. Excellence, almost by definition, excels the standard. It goes beyond it, which is why you need the follow through and follow up. So you get your job done. Yeah, I remember I've worked a number of jobs. One of which I was a ditch digger out in the Sierra Nevada mountains one summer in college. And they told us we wouldn't dig ditches, but then we get out there and like next week we're digging ditches. You know, it's like, it was through my roommate's dad, so we couldn't quit. And one of the guys there who's, you know, life, you know, this was his life ambition to be a ditch digger, I guess. Basically, I heard the phrase for the first time, good enough for who it's for. So it was just like, do whatever it is based on what you think the person would accept. No excellence involved. And then later, I eventually heard the line, which I thought was humorous at first, and now I see how disastrous this line is. Good enough for government work. That's why the West Side Highway fell into, you know, basically collapsed, because people did basically, it was a bogus contract. And if you ever did any reading about why we had West Side Highway disappeared, you'll find out that it was shoddy workmanship and poor materials, basically due to bribes. So competence is the first thing you have to strive for, but then you have to show initiative and some other things, persistence and diligence, to excel. And you have to have that as your objective. So I'm going to look at the decision that Heracles had to make at a crossroads when he was met by Arete and Kakia. And it's written by one of Socrates' disciples. And you can find this on your own, because I'm only going to read some of it. I got to figure out how to get out of here to get to my other screen. Wait, this probably will do it. Oh boy, I got lots of screens up. Let's see. I also have another fun thing I want you to do between now and then. Here it is. Okay. Hey, great. I didn't have to get all the way up. So, when I had to teach Western Civ, I had to acquaint myself. I had all these philosophical books on my shelves that, you know, I thought would be nice to read someday. Wikipedia was wonderful. It directed me to stuff that I really needed to know, and I could pretend that I knew what was going on. This quote is one I'd seen by Hesiod, this guy down here, who was around, oh, I think he's like 750, one of these guys is 750 BC. This is like before the Israelites went into captivity in Assyria the first time. So it's just that, like, just after Troy, Homer, that time period, the Dark Ages of Greek stuff. And this second quote is the one, but let's get a little context here. Moreover, indolence, laziness, and present enjoyment can never bring the body into good condition, as trainers say. Neither do they put the soul in knowledge of any value. But, pay attention to this one, strenuous effort leads up to good and noble deeds, as good men say. So you take the easy path, just think about it in the physical realm, you're not going to succeed. Look at the people who, you know, basically get a trainer versus those who don't. So it puts the person in, you know, into, no jokes, no comments. Okay. And then he quotes Hesiod, wickedness can be had in abundance easily. Smooth is the road and very nigh she dwells. In other words, the easy path is right there. Like, it's like you're almost on it. It's smooth and easy. But in front of virtue, the gods immortal have put sweat. Long and steep is the path to her, and rough at first. But when you reach the top, then at length, the road is easy, though hard it was to get there. Okay? Anybody hear Jesus' Sermon on the Mount? Similar thing right there. Okay, then we're going to get to the my Heracles story. And the reason I shared those with you is, you know, every once in a while, explore some stuff the old Greeks said, because the old Greeks were pretty wise. And he talks about some guy, Proteus, who basically used to tell this story. So this is supposedly the only story of the interchange between Arete and Kakia, excellence and evil. Notice the difference between those two. When Heracles was passing from boyhood to youth's estate, in other words, he's now an adolescent, were the young now beginning to be their own master to show whether they will approach life by the path of virtue or vice, he went out to a quiet place. Background. Almost all the ancient Near East wisdom literature had two paths. Good one, bad one. And you had to choose. And you couldn't go on both because the paths went in opposite directions. That is true in the Sermon on the Mount. It's true in our lives today. You need to basically, as your own master, of course, Jesus is our master, but we make the decisions as to who is going to be our master. We need to basically pick path of virtue or the path of vice. And the easiest is a path of vice. And kakia is actually, I think, mentioned as vice in this translation. Okay. He sat pondering which road to take, and there approached two women of great stature. So in the Greeks, when you had a great stature, it was a god. Approaching to him. One was fair to see and high bearing, and her limbs were adorned with purity, and her eyes with modesty. Sober was her figure, which I probably sound minded, or it's basically she was lean and mean, and her robe was white. The other was plump and soft with high feeding. So I guess she sat a little too long at the feast tables. Her face was made up to heighten its natural white and pink, her figure to exaggerate her height. Open-eyed was she, as opposed to, chaste and, she was considered a brazen hussy. She was dressed to as disclose all her charms. I think the Wikipedia condensation of this re referred to it as she was plump with too much makeup and basically dressed to reveal too much of herself, which she shouldn't be revealing. These people still exist if you walk through the city. I'm sure there's some people in your office that you'd probably think, you've been finishing up those donuts too much. Anyway, open-eyed was she, dressed to disclose all her charms. I love this line. She eyed herself. Anon looked whether any noticed her. So if she's there, like, see me? And often stole a glance at her own shadow, and I'm sure sighed appreciatively. So she's basically very much taken with herself. And she kind of represents vice and lust. When they drew near to Heracles, the first pursued the even tenor of her way. So arete is basically doing the walk, moderation, looking good. But Kikia, the other, all eager to outdo her, ran to meet him, probably the only exercise she ever got, crying, Heracles, I see that you are in doubt which path to take towards life. Make me your friend, follow me, and I will lead you among the pleasantest and easiest road. You shall taste all the sweetness of life, and hardship you will never know. Sounds like a good deal. Right? She's promising him all the good stuff in life without having to do any work for it. First, of wars and worries you shall not think, but shall ever be considering what choice food or drink you can find. So don't worry about wars, don't worry about worrying. The major thing you should worry about is, will you have the roast lamb or will you have the roast beef? And it might be a little difficult, but you're gonna have to figure out which sauce you want on them. That's all you want. What sound or sight will delight you? That's what you all have to figure out about. Or what touch or perfume, what tender love can give you the most joy, what bed the softest slumbers, and how to come eye all these pleasures with the least amount of trouble. This woman basically lives in our time today. I think she lives on Madison Avenue, comes up with advertisements. And should there arise any misgivings that lack of means may stint your enjoyment, so in other words, you can't afford it, never fear that I may lead you into winning them by toil and anguish of body and soul. Nay, you shall have the fruits of others' labors. Okay? You shall have the fruits of others' toils. You shall refrain from nothing that can bring you gain, for to my companions I will give authority to pluck advantage where they will, which basically means you don't have to worry about working. You'll never have to do that. I will give you all the stuff. I will give you the power to just take other people's stuff so you can enjoy it. So, what's wrong with this picture? Well, as Xenophon is writing this, remember he put that quote there about the good path and the bad path actually preceded this? So the readers back in his time would know, well, wait a minute, that's the wrong path. That's the path to evil. And then I'll just give you what Arete says when she catches up. And when Heracles heard this, he said, "Lady, pray, what is your name?" And she said, "My friends call me Happiness. But among those that hate me, I'm nicknamed Vice." Kakia is the Greek word, which means evil. And here the translator put it as vice. So, fortunately, Heracles waits for the second opinion, and he probably knows that vice is not good. Meanwhile, the other, Arete, had drawn near, and she said, "I too am come to you, Heracles. I know your parents, and I've taken note of your character during the time of your education." You know who his father was? Zeus. Therefore, I hope that if you take the road that leads to me, you will turn out a right good doer of high and noble deeds. And I shall be yet more highly favored and more illustrious for the blessings I bestow. But I will not deceive you by a pleasant prelude. I will tell you rather truly the things that are as the gods have ordained them." So what's Heracles known for? His mighty deeds, right? He's not known for his parting. So you kind of know which one he's going to pick. But I think she has one more piece. You know, we do know a couple people in history known for their debaucheries, but they're not people to emulate. Then Arete goes on to say, "For all things good and fair, the gods give nothing to man without toil and effort." Rats. This is supposed to be the true story. All right. So Kakia sounded good, Happiness sounded good, but the gods have ordained a different thing, as our God has as well. "If you want the favor of gods, you must worship the gods. If you desire the love of friends, you must be good to your friends. If you covet honor from a city, you must aid that city. If you are fain to win the admiration of all Hellas," which is Greek, the Greece as a nation, "for virtue, you must strive to do good for Hellas," or Greece. "If you want to land the land to yield your fruits in abundance, you must cultivate that land. If you resolve to get wealth from flocks, you must care for those flocks. If you essay to grow great through war and want power to liberate your friends and subdue your foes, you must learn the arts of war from those who know them and must practice their right use. And if you want your body to be strong, you must accustom your body to be the servant of your mind." There it is right there. "And train it with toil and sweat." We need to develop objectives that govern our passions, which is going to take toil and sweat. There is no shortcut. This is 700 or so years before Christ. The world has not changed. I've kind of studied people all the way through. That's the way you get it. And let's see if there's a thing to end this on. And vice, as Prodicius tells us. Prodicius, in the beginning, he's traveling like a minstrel. He went around and told these stories to people. And if this was the common culture of Greece in that day, you can kind of imagine how they became so great. Because their common people were understanding this. It was reinforcing right principles. And if you look at our culture, this is as alien as ancient Greece. Just it's not, but the principles are biblical and they're still the same. So Vice answers, "Heracles, mark how hard and long is that road to joy, of which this woman tells. But I will lead you by a short and easy road to happiness," said the serpent in the garden. And then let's see how Arete responds. She addresses Vice. "What good thing is thine, poor wretch, or what pleasant thing dost thou know, if you will do naught to win them?" Okay, so like, it's not good if you don't have to work to win it. "Do you not even tarry for the desire of pleasant things, but fill yourself with all the things before you even desire them? Eating before you're hungry, drinking before you're thirsty, getting the cooks to give you zest to eating." Boy, that's endemic of our day. Buying the costly wines and running to and fro in search of snow in the summer. Aspen, here we come. To give zest to drinking, to soothe thy slumbers, it's not enough for thee to buy soft coverlets, but thou must have frames for the bed. Yeah, it goes on and on. So I'll let you continue on that if you wish, but I need to get back to our regularly scheduled program. So, people who are excellent have struggled with getting there. You have to struggle or you don't get it. You can't, there's no shortcut. So I have something to break into your thinking with app. It's not an app. There's an app for that. Oh, there's an app for excellence. Great, I'll just get that. Short for application, folks. You need to purpose to please God just like Daniel did. You need to seek help from the Holy Spirit because he wants to guide you into this. We're basically going to be told in the scriptures, the first thing we're supposed to add to our faith, says 2 Peter, is arete, not ate. We need to find out what are the objectives and standards that God has for us and the work what our boss has for us. In relationships, what's expected. And we need to keep the steps in blueprint focus. I'm not sure if that's an alien concept to you, but there are people who work on building houses, and they often will go and build, knock the wrong things together. Our place was being built. We had some modifications, and we snuck in there when we weren't supposed to see how they were doing. And it was just like they put the lights in the wrong spot. They put doors where they weren't supposed to put doors. They didn't put doors where they were supposed to be doors. And we had to kind of go back to our salesperson and say, hey, you know, we're not supposed to have been there, but this stuff isn't being built like it's supposed to, and I'd much rather have it torn down now. And we kind of went in and marked, you know, we wanted the lights put over the center of the table because the electrician was just throwing them anywhere. You know, it's like they were looking at the blueprint to make sure that every step they took matched the instructions. When our place up at Willamilak was built, the builder couldn't understand the blueprints because they were so complicated. So he had the architect build him a model. And I was told that the guy who was a master carpenter went, measured the model, measured it twice, cut the piece of wood. Measured the model, cut the piece of wood. He kept going back to make sure that the piece fit into the objective. And I think sometimes people who are really good on the persistence and the diligence fail to keep the blueprint in focus. What am I supposed to be building? So, you know, those people who have a more judging tendencies, you can excel, but make sure you don't excel in the wrong thing. You people have perceiving tendencies. Get on the stick. Okay. I put myself in that class. You need to be competent and then selectively excellent. You can't be excellent in all things. Choose wisely. So I'm going to give you an assignment. No. Yeah, I kind of got to teach you one. Sorry about that. And we'll pick it up from here next week. Down below, one of the things that I talk about is taking heed to yourself. And I was thinking as I did that, what does heed mean? And I looked it up in a dictionary. It comes from a, you know, old German word that kind of means to pay attention to something, to guard. But here's a cool thing. Go to the online Bible. I don't think most of you have seen this. And let's type in a word, heed. Just an English word. And then we get a bunch of things. Taking heed to yourself, keep your soul diligently. God, look how many times are in Deuteronomy. Remind them to do that. And then you got a bunch in the New Testament about taking heed to yourself. If you take heed to yourself, then you'll do well at the judgment seat. There's lots of good verses on heed. So you can read through them all. But here's a cute little thing. Not cute little thing. Cute. No, it's nifty. Is nifty a word? All right. Click on the word. Click on the word. Oh, come on. It worked before. Wow, maybe it was New Testament. No. This is you can pull up a topical thing. Oh man. Okay. I'll figure out what's wrong. But it's going to pull up an article from maybe the Bible Dictionary. Maybe I do I have to have Strong's numbers? No, it's an article that actually tells you the importance of taking heed in the Christian life. I will cut and paste it and send it around in the future to be able to do that. But normally, whenever you have an underlined word or a word, you can click on it, see if any of these work. They're not coming up for me today. What? Oh, thanks. Nope, it didn't do it. All right. So they'll actually give you a topical study. And what this topical study did, that's the Greek, it kind of gives that. So I would encourage you to do that. I'll get it working next week. I'll make a screenshot of it. And I think we're about out of time. Any last questions? Yep. So just go to Online Bible, pull up the word heed, look at some of the verses, and click on it because we will be talking about heeding next week. And I'd like to remind you of this application. And there's some questions down below on your sheet that are worth giving some thought to. Okay, who's here? Let's pray. Heavenly Father, we thank you that you're a God who calls us to excellence, who gives us the power to be able to do it by your Holy Spirit, gives us guidance in your word and in the fellowship of believers to be able to strive for the things that are excellent, the things that reflect well on you, that glorify you rather than ourselves. May we be believers like Daniel and Caleb, who were used by you to bring yourself glory. We commit ourselves to this task. In Christ's name, amen.